Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Idalise Malave, co-author with SD Giordani of Latino Stats, American Hispanics by the Numbers, published by the New Press in 2015. Idalise is an organizational consultant who ran the Tides Foundation in California for 11 years and was also the vice president of the Miss Foundation. She has also co-authored another book with Elizabeth DeBold and Marie Wilson entitled Mother-Daughter Revolution. Hello, Idalise, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, DJ. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I'm excited to have you on the channel and to discuss a lot of the really interesting, you know, facts and tidbits that are covered in your book. I was hoping you could just begin our discussion by telling us a little bit about yourself, you know, with your personal and professional background.
Sure. So I'm a longtime social justice activist. I've been active in Latino movement, women's movement for decades. It is one of the great satisfactions of my life that I've gotten to do that. And I've written a few books along the way. And this book was particularly fun and satisfying to do because I got to write it with my daughter.
Right. And can you tell us a little bit about how the book itself came about? You know, how did you start to think of this project and you know, start to organize it and eventually find the publisher and all that?
So the publisher, the New Press, which is a fabulous and unique publisher, in that it's not for profit and really has a social and economic and environmental justice mission in the world, actually was sought me out first. I knew the publisher, and we were talking, and the conversation was really, they had done a book on African Americans called Black Stats. But the conversation was really about the reality that here in the United States, people tend to focus on these days on how many of us there are and are going to be, right? The changing demographics, you know, we're going to outnumber, you know, this group and that group in so many decades. And they don't focus nearly enough on who we are.
Right.
And there are so many misconceptions that this felt like an opportunity to actually surprise people into the realities of, you know, this is generalizations and it's data and, you know, but the realities of Latino life, in fact, in this country.
No, certainly. And you open the book with that, I think, you know, addressing this issue of the misconceptions about the Latino population and typically how it's discussed in media, particularly around, you know, election season, which is going on now, where there are these underlying fears about this, you know, the, you know, all these, you know, ocean-like water metaphors are used, you know, the rising tide, you know, these waves of migrants, all these types of, you know, language that's alarmist in nature and refers to a, you know, the demographic transition that's occurring and that's, you know, frankly been occurring for decades now, as something that's really a matter of, you know, peril for, you know, the nation, for its own sense of identity. You know, refer to, you know, these fears about the unassimilable, you know, Latinos that, you know, in the introduction, as well as just the underlying racism that is a deep-seated part of, you know, our country's history. And so how those kind of, those intersect, right? And those became part of the motivation, right, for this book to really dispel a lot of these myths and concerns.
Absolutely. And one of, I am ashamed to say that one of the surprises in doing the research for me, something that I did not know, as familiar as I am, you know, I was born in Puerto Rico, I'm an immigrant, as familiar as I am with all of the anti-immigrant rhetoric, right, that surrounds us, right, I did not know that in the 1930s, the United States, under President Hoover, deported 1 million Mexican heritage residents and citizens of the United States. A million.
Right. Yeah.
600,000 of them were citizens, just right. randomly picked up on the streets, put in a bus, and, you know, driven into Mexico and dropped. You know, good luck to you there. So I do think, right, that these cultural and economic fears, right, they kind of, they get intertwined.
Exactly.
In a way that I think is coinciding. I just read the other day in the Times, the columnist Blow did a whole piece about white America's broken heart, right? This mm-hmm. identity crisis mm-hmm. That is underway. And yet, you know, one of the data that interested me was, you know, particularly the lightning rod for so much of this hate rhetoric and action are undocumented immigrants, many of whom are Latino.
Right.
And yet, you know, I think it's something like, depending on whether you're Republican or Democrat, like 7 or 8, you know, slightly higher among Democrats, out of 10 Americans, feels that hardworking, they should be allowed to stay and live in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, I have my sense, and maybe it's what I want to believe, but my sense is that the nasty rhetoric, right, is not 100% aligned with what actually your average Americans think and feel. But it's something that some feel, and some are almost being made to feel by some of these really ugly voices that we're being, you know, that are out there on the air. I won't even say his name.
Thank you. I agree. But no, I
won't say his name.
I agree. And I think that you're right. There is a very loud and vocal, influential minority that gets a lot of the airplay and gets to stir the fear or control the narrative and thereby, you know, drive and, you know, dissent and you know, certain types of opinion, particularly when it comes to issues of, you know, ethnicity and race and immigration. I mean, with you look at the facts that, you know, Latinos have become the face of the immigration debate, despite the fact, and we'll get into the statistics later, that a very, very small population of Latinos, number one, are undocumented immigrants, but that also that whole concept and discussion around and documentation and dare I say, you know, use the word I hate to use is illegal or alienage, you know, that gets marked onto Latino bodies, despite the fact that there are many Europeans,
exactly.
There are Canadians, there are other immigrants from various parts of the world that overstay visas and are here illegally as well. And yet they are not covered in that discussion. So I agree.
And often equated. I mean, all Latinos, right?
It's the
numbers, as you noted, are not that high, right? 17% of Latinos, more or less, are undocumented immigrants. But the reality is that over 2/3 of Latinos were born here in the United States.
Right.
We're not even immigrants, mm-hmm. right? Many of us, right? And yet, you know, that the face, as you said, of the unwanted, illegal, right, immigrant is invariably a Latino face.
Certainly. And before we're going to get into a number of these things, we're going to go by topic, and that's what the book does. The book breaks down all of these stats. It's organized very nicely by chapter according to topics going from immigration to the economy, education, etc. We're going to go through a number of those. And then each chapter, I'll point out, too, for our readers, has a nice opening, you know, snippet that gives a summary, an introduction into the statistics that are covered. And it all reads very nicely. I really have to, you know, commend
you
on the way the book is organized. I like how each chapter has the initial, you know, Snapchat view or Snapstat view that gives you kind of an overview of the rest of the chapter, and then you know, it goes through by different subsections. So it's by no means you know, really, I think, redundant or anything like that. It actually reads very nicely and quite easily. I just wanted to cover really quick and have you speak of the sources. Where did you get all these statistics from? If you can make a few, just a comment.
Sure. I think we noted it in the introduction, but mm-hmm. we relied a lot on census figures, other government agencies that right. collect the data. In some cases, polling and marketing. You know, one of the things I discovered in this process is that marketing and ad companies are more interested in who Latinos are than politicians are. You know, they want to know everything right. about us, right? Because we spend, you know, $1.5 trillion a year. They're very interested in us. But we managed to do most of the research online. What was one of the Herculean tasks of this book is every statistic in this book is footnoted.
Right.
Every bit of data. And the reason that we did this is because we know that this data, you know, particularly in this day and age, is going to get old fast,
mm-hmm.
right? Some of it doesn't, right? Like the census data, it takes a while to update it, given the 10-year span between census taking. But we figured if you had the source, and most of them are online sources, you can go and see what the latest number is. We give you the site, off you go, and you can find it. So I would say the sources are rock solid. There's nothing in here at any point, and, you know, this is also, you know, New Press has very high standards. If we right. were even tempted to put something that wasn't from a rock-solid source. But I think it's useful for folks also in just knowing what some of the key sources for some of this data. Some of it is not obvious, you know. Disease control captures all sorts of data.
That's true, right?
Right? That has to do with public health, but you don't necessarily go there when you're looking for that other data.
Yes, and I'll add it. References are quite well noted. There's at least 40 pages, I'm looking here, of notes in the back where everything is footnoted. And I, you know, I spent some time going through the notes because I was just very curious myself of where the sources were. And they are, you know, the typically, you know, government reports or nonprofits or things like, you know, the Pew Research Center. Pretty much you're looking at very credible.
Oh, I should, of course, say something about Pew. Pew Research, God bless them. I don't know what Latinos would do without them.
Right.
They have been compiling data, you know, year after year after year. They're solid, and they also compile data that turns out to be particularly useful. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in the area of racial identification, you know, the census goes yeah. so much, as we all know, right? How mm-hmm. you ask the question often determines what answer you'll get.
Exactly.
The census asks the question one way and gets a series of answers and data. Pew asks the question another way, and you learn that actually, over half of Latinos identify as not, you know, ni blanco ni negro. It's sort mm-hmm. of like some mm-hmm. other race or mix, more than half of us.
Right.
So it's a very important source. Thank you for mentioning it, DJ.
Certainly, certainly. And also there's a very handy index in the back too. So I think it's just very, you know, easy to manage this thing, this book and find the stats you want. It can be a very, you know, quick reference for those interested. It also can be, like I said, you can just sit down and take a few chapters at a time and read through it. So, again, just a very well put together book. All right. So let's get into this and let's, start with kind of the big stuff, the basics, if you will. I got my handy copy here. So we'll start with this, you know, the general population, right? Latinos, roughly about 53 million Latinos living in the United States right now, currently, which is the second largest ethno-racial demographic, but the largest minority demographic, right? In the United States as of now.
That's right. One in six Americans
are
Latino right now.
You know, and actually, I even forgot to say before we get... Oh, no, I'm going to bring this up in immigration, so we'll keep going. So, yes, just the big picture stuff, projections, right? 2050, they're projected that there will be around somewhere around 112 million Latinos by 2050. Right. So essentially almost more than doubling the current population within the next, oh, God, what is that, 35, 34 years or so, right?
Right. And some of those, you know, with a lot of those... Some of them say it's 2042, some say 2050. It depends on your...
Right.
But certainly around that time, one in three Americans will be Latino.
Right. Wow. That's fascinating. And that's when they are... And I saw a recent study on this from Pew as well, that it's when they project around that time, he say, give or take 5 to 10 years of that 2050 landmark, that the new majority will emerge. That is, that minorities then... widespread will outnumber the aging Anglo and white population. That's what's being predicted.
Absolutely. And that is largely true because of the growth of the Latino population. The actual percentage of African Americans is not going to grow that much. But the Latino portion, if you will, of the American population is the one that's expanding at a prodigious rate.
Right. That, and I'll also say, is the, according to this Pew study I was recently looking at, it also was discussing the rapid rise in the Asian population.
I should mention that.
Really the growth in the Latino and the Asian population, and that somewhere again, I don't have that Pew study right in front of me, but it's around this time as well. I think it's about 20, 30 years in the future that Asian immigration, that is going to outpace and outnumber actually Latino immigration as far as an immigrant group, right?
That's right.
Yes.
Particularly when you think, and you know, one of the, I think, important pieces of data for people just to know generally, particularly in, you know, given the nasty immigration conversation that's going on, is that immigration from Mexico, right, which is where most people point, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a significant number of immigrants do come from Mexico, so it's not totally unreasonable. But actually net migration from Mexico is now zero.
Right. And it's been zero for a few years. I think since
2011. Yeah,
2011.
You're absolutely right.
2011, yeah. Yeah, and that's something that you and this is nice. This is dovetailed right into the discussion on immigration, and I want to ask to kind of cover immigration and jobs and the economy all together, which we'll do in various ways because I think they're so intricately tied. But that is a key point, right? That is missed in the media and popular discourse, particularly in right now in our political season, is all this concern about we're focusing on a border that is experiencing net zero migration, right? Where
even it's
more
insane.
People are returning to Mexico than are coming to the United States, and yet we are still entertaining crazy notions of building walls and wasting even more money on a border
billions.
That we know for various reasons does not essentially work
in
at least the way
and
that it's discussed.
And for a threat that doesn't really exist.
Exactly.
I mean, if you want to call it a threat, right, it doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah.
It makes no sense, but that doesn't seem to – that the fact that it has no rhyme or reason doesn't seem to affect the discourse at all.
No, and that was driven home to me yesterday too. I'm a podcast junkie, and since naturally I run one, but then I like to listen to a lot of it, so I get a lot of my information. And I was listening to a podcast. This is more of a news program, and it's really covering exit polls in New Hampshire. And they're interviewing a person that voted for He Who Shall Not Be Named. And asked why this person voted for that candidate. And the response was, well, because he's going to build a wall. And then so the rejoining question was, well, why is that important to you? And he says, well, you know, it's going to stop, you know, the terrorism. It's going to stop, you know, like the Syrians and from coming over and ISIS. And I thought, oh, my gosh, how the heck is this person connecting the southern border with ISIS, you know, and it just goes to show, right? It's about the, so much of this has to do with what is actually heard. It has nothing to do with facts.
No,
it has to do with what is getting played over and over again in the media.
Fear mongering.
Exactly. Fear mongering and how there is no connection between, international terrorism and the southern border. Despite, you know, the efforts to the contrary, by those that would make that connection. You know, yet it does somehow resonate and it does somehow connect with voters and with the populace that, man, doing one thing is going to solve another. And you're right. It's that connection between, you know, pointing to something that's visible or making it even more visible, particularly marking it on bodies and saying, this is how we solve the problem and all these things that you're afraid of, all these boogeymen we can solve by one thing. You know, and it's just
that's
it's
right.
Build this
and
wall
look and over like, here, look over here, white middle class, while we totally continue, right, to erode your wealth and your wages.
Yes.
Right? It's a very effective,
it's a sleight of hand.
You know,
it is very
sleight
crafty.
Of hand. Thank you. Exactly what I was looking for, right? And it's just appalling. Anyhow, but you were
going to
ask.
I'm forgetting now.
don't worry.
But so we're talking about immigration. The other thing that gets lost, right? And I was introduced to this this particular fact, and this will resonate with you, being from Puerto Rico. When we think of the 500 year presence, which this is hardly ever mentioned, of Latinos and Hispanics on, you know, in the Western Hemisphere on the American continent. Particularly when we're looking at history, the way history is taught. There is a recent book published by Felipe, I'm forgetting his name, Fernandez Armesto from the University of Notre Dame, and the book's called Our America.
Our America.
Right.
Yep.
It's a great book.
I love that book.
It starts by talking about European colonization and how and this resonates with me because I have three daughters actually, but one's in fifth grade, and so she's going through American history curriculum, and they're doing this walk through the Revolution play, and so of course they're talking about the founding of the English colonies, and so the teaching of American history, what is now contiguously America, always begins in, you know, either Plymouth Rock or Jamestown, and one of the major points that Professor Fernandez Armesto makes is that actually the initial successful European colonies were not English, that they were Spanish, and that I had assumed that would have been, you know, Florida. I was thinking maybe St. Augustine,
right.
Or maybe even
Puerto
Santa
Rico.
Fe, New Mexico. Yeah, but you're right. It was Puerto Rico.
Mm-hmm.
And 100 years.
It was
100
Puerto
years
Rico.
Before Jamestown. Right, 100 years before Jamestown,
well,
Puerto Rico.
The fact that I learned from that book as well, and we started the book with a quote from him because I love that book so much and love that he was doing this kind of revisionist, wait a second, here's some real history, take on American history by introducing this information. But before Jamestown, the Spanish had explored 48 out of the 50 states.
Right.
They'd already they'd explored it, discovered it to the extent that we were discoverable. And that's also ignored. As is the fact that a third of this country was annexed in one way or other through war, treaty, or whatever, from Spain and Mexico.
Right.
In the 19th century. So it's a distortion, right? You know, that old saw about history belongs to the victors.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly seems to be in play here.
No, certainly, and I agree. I think it's one of the primary draws, and perhaps why I decided to teach history and become a historian was, you know, this information that I became aware of in college that I was just so blown away of and shocked that I hadn't learned, in, growing up, in the United States and attending K through 12 schools, was a whole other side of history from, and I always hesitate to say it's ethnic history because I don't think it's ethnic history. I think it's American history. I think, if you want to call anything exactly. ethnic history, all of American history is compartmentalized into ethnic history, right? Or the founding and, the history that covers New England colonies, that's ethnic history as much as anything else. So, but yeah, so much of that message, and it speaks to the weight, I think, the importance of this, because, that lack of perspective that rarely comes into public dialogue and public debate, particularly as you just mentioned, right, the war of conquest enacted upon Mexico that led to the cession of the northern half of Mexico, now the southwestern United States, and not to mention, of course, the expansion into the Pacific Islands, and Puerto Rico is rarely ever mentioned. And again, in that conversation, Puerto Rico is incredibly important. Puerto Ricans are always mentioned and referred to as immigrants when, they've had United States citizenship since, 1917 with the Jones Act. So it's just, all these things are lost in that discussion. But that perspective and context is so important because it really allows one to set a critical foundation for really questioning what then is referred to and repeated in the media.
Well, I think shapes the current narrative, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you ignore that history, then you're able to cast Latinos in this case as the usurpers, right? Instead of the usurped, right? It's fascinating, right? I mean, we were here. Thank you. Native Americans were here for thousands
exactly.
of years, 14 or 17, depending on who's counting.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been here for 500 years, longer than other Europeans. But somehow we still, Latino immigrants, are the usurpers,
mm-hmm.
right? Taking what's not ours in some way,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As if we were taking away. One of the facts that I knew was generally true, but I never had the data before, was, again, in the area of immigration. When people, this anti-immigrant rhetoric, right? The free ride.
Yeah.
Right? free ride makes me crazy. But when they started counting, they found, I think it was in 2012, over $10 billion in state taxes, property, income,
right.
different kinds of state taxes were contributed by undocumented immigrants.
Right.
As what free ride? And the other side of that is Latinos generally as a group don't take advantage of government entitlements, the other form of free ride, to the proportion that we're in the population. We're less likely to actually get Medicaid, or et cetera, or food stamps. It's just so frustrating, infuriating, frankly.
No, it is, that's exactly also where I wanted this conversation to go. We've talked about the bigger numbers of immigration, in that, that the two-thirds or so, first of all, is the majority of Latinos, the vast majority, two-thirds of Latinos are actually American-born, so they're not immigrants. There's a small proportion, 17%, that are actually undocumented immigrants, and we've mentioned also the net zero migration since essentially 2011. But then what's also lost, as you've mentioned, is within the economic discussions and the costs of migration are, one, as you've mentioned, the free ride, which also does not mention the context of migrants and the cost of migration, thousands and thousands of dollars. There's an article I just read a couple weeks ago, putting into a factor of, the migrants that are coming from Central America now, roughly at about $7,000 to $10,000 on average is what that trip costs,
right.
in paying for the various services and
right.
that are involved in that, in getting across the multiple borders and the travel that's involved. So it's the generally the depiction with undocumented immigration is that it's a bunch of, you know, poor people that are, you know, just prancing across the border or sneaking across
right.
it with
sneaking
no money,
in, right?
With no money.
Right.
The context of their recruitment is ignored. The fact that we have U.S. industries and businesses that profit off of their exploited labor and lobby Congress heavily for that. And this has been, I mean, this is going on for over 100 years. This has been going on forever, right? So this is nothing new per se, but, you know, all of that, both the cost that migrants themselves, you know, have to pay monetarily, not to mention emotionally and physically, and then that strong connection between U.S. business is lost. But within all that, okay, within all that, that free ride discussion is also what's ignored is the dependency of our nation, not just, you know, economic in regards to forms of cheap labor, because that's one thing that's sometimes discussed. But I would like you to speak to this to some point. You know, in what ways are, you know, are immigrants vital to our economy and particularly the social safety net if we are to keep that and sustain moving forward?
It's such an important point, DJ. You know, there's a professor in California, Manuel Pastor.
Mm-hmm.
I heard him say this once, and it's always stuck in my mind, that immigration is not the cause of American economic woes. It's actually the solution.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reality is that ours, Latinos, a very young population, right? I think the average age is about 27, a little in a few months, right?
Right.
Is and much younger than, I think it's 42 for whites. This is an aging population. So when you have an aging workforce and you depend on something like Social Security, right, which is funded, right, the benefits that older people get are funded by money that's, you know, been put aside, but also by the money that's coming in from younger people now,
mm-hmm.
right? If there aren't, right, if your labor force is shrinking, right, because people are aging out of it, and your birth rates, you know, you have to increase one way or another through birth rates and some combination with immigration. The rate of aging in the United States cannot be compensated for with our existing birth rates.
Exactly.
We need immigrants in order to have a workforce to actually keep our economy strong, but also to keep that safety net in place for older people. So we're not a problem. Immigrants are not a problem. We're a solution. We're needed, you know, and not just as you said, you know, there's a wonderful movie, A Day Without a Mexican, right? Not just because we do the jobs, gardeners and whatever that other, you know, taking care of the kids, all the stuff that other folks don't want to do apparently. No. It's because in the future, we're a key part of the workforce that's going to keep this country moving, the economy moving, and supporting older people.
You know, it's so true. And it reminds me of a few years ago when I was working on a research project, I stumbled upon an article from the New York Times that talked about the surplus that, if you will, if you could use that, that the Social Security was administration was running because it was actually collecting taxes off of undocumented immigrants that were using false Social Security. Well, not false Social Security numbers, but they were using Social Security numbers that weren't theirs, you know. But that so there's a couple of ironies in that for me. That number one, that the Social Security administration really had no problem continuing to collect all this money.
They'll take our money to pay real Americans,
and,
right?
You know, sit this money in a surplus. But that's essentially that was the one of the points of this New York Times piece was that that's what was keeping this, you know, Social Security Administration afloat in the years moving forward are not just, of course, the Social Security taxes that undocumented immigrants pay, but that was the focus of that article, but in general that immigrants themselves pay. So those that do
and Latinos in this country, period, mm-hmm. right?
Right, exactly.
So it's really, I think it's really important. I'm glad you raised it.
Well, that figure is staggering. That 10.6, I think it was 10.6 or 10.7 billion, right? And that was the the figure you
in 2012 in state taxes.
Wow!
And the states themselves collected this data, right? They have an agreement,
right?
So
and see, and that's
it's
usually
not
the...
it's not Latinos, you know, going in and saying, "Oh yeah, we you know." No, the states collected the data.
And that's important because that's usually the counter argument. The counter argument to this idea that, okay, well, there's the idea, well, maybe the federal government is actually benefiting from undocumented migration because the Social Security Administration is getting a boost. But what about states and municipalities? And that's where the argument is that all the costs are absorbed and, you know, it's unfair. And that's why you have the subfederal right. immigration policy movement from states like Arizona and, you know, Alabama, Georgia. I mean, all throughout that just happened a couple of years ago where this was, there's really a boom.
But it's also, I think it's there in some states, you know, more progressive states, mm-hmm. Where you have some municipalities kind of going, no, 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 we're going to take care of our immigrants, mm-hmm. documented or undocumented. Mm-hmm. We need them. Our economy right. needs them. You know, our tax revenues depend on them.
Right.
So you're seeing policies, you know, New York City putting out, you know, the identification card to make right. life easier for everyone, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're
California
seeing
giving
policies.
Driver's licenses.
Yep, and California led the way, so
yeah,
very important as well.
I agree, and let's move on to the. Let's move on to talking about. We've talked a bit about jobs and the economy a little bit. Well, maybe we can talk about a couple other things in regards to the economy. What other? I'll tell you one surprising statistic that also stood out to me in the chapter on jobs and the economy was. I have to find the page here. Let me pull it up. But it was on essentially pointing out to the growth of the Latino middle class, and I think it's on page 44 here. And the stats shows. Says here, Latino households that earn $50,000 or more are growing at a faster rate than all American households. And that was between 2000 and 2011, that the number of Latino households with earnings between $50,000 to $74,900 grew by 10%, while households
That's right.
with earnings at the level for the total U.S. population saw very little growth. So this is a, and there are a few other stats that expand on this and support it, but this is also another point that is ignored in, you know, much of the popular, you know, media discourse is that Latinos and the growth of a middle class among Latinos is outpacing any other demographic group. You know, it's not to ignore
That's
that
right.
there's a heavily urban
and
Latino population.
And you see it not only in these numbers that have to do with revenue, right, with income, mm-hmm. But you also see it, you know, Latinos, in particular Latina women, are, you know, driving the small business expansion we're seeing in this country as well. We're disproportionately driving that. But, you know, I think it's important, though, when we talk about the economy, this is that we talk not just about income, mm-hmm. but that we talk about wealth, right? Kind of that goes beyond what money comes in, but do you own your house? Do you have a car? And that's a place where, one, Latinos got hit really hard in the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009, right? Really, really hard, losing, I think it was 44% of our wealth in that recession. But the wealth gap, the existing wealth gap, is that a white American, right, their wealth is 12 times. The average white American is 12 times greater than the average Latino.
Right.
Not a little bit. You know, when it comes to earnings, there's like, you know, the average wage, I think, income for whites is about 50, and for Latinos back in, you know, this is a few years now, but was $39 million, right? An $11 million difference. But this isn't a little difference. And, you know, that seems like such a little difference compared to they have 12 times more wealth than we do.
Right.
More likely to own a house, own a car, you know, have an investment account, money in the bank, all of those things. It's a really, I think, key inequity and a place where we as Latinos really need to, you know, put some energy and work into getting to, you know, to turn it around right. in some way.
Well, and since we're going to be moving our conversation to voting and politics, I think it's an important also, right, opportunity for, you know, the emerging, what continues to be referred to as an emerging, although it's a very deeply historical voting demographic, that being Latinos. is that it's an opportunity. It's a policy opportunity, right? To push politicians to do things that
Absolutely.
Remove the barriers that it, that stand in the way of, you know, Latinos and not just Latinos, but, you know, other immigrants as well that, that, in, you know, face and come, you know, up to, you know, very
and other
strong
people
barriers
of
to
color
their advancement.
In this country.
Exactly.
You know, it's 12 times more, right, than what wealth of whites and what Latinos have, but it's 14 times more than what Black Americans have.
Right.
You know, it's, yeah, it's too much.
Mm-hmm.
We need to get to the voting. We need to vote, you know, actually use our voting power more and more effectively, and we will. I think all of the data actually points to the fact that even though, you know, our voting rate in the last election, I think was about at 48%,
right.
under half of eligible voters, which was a little bit lower than it had been in the prior, 2008 election.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you actually, and this is one of the places where Pew research is really strong, where you do the real analysis of, you know, so who are the non-voters? Why is it that people don't vote? What is that about? And there's some generally true trends in voting, which is that younger voters have a lower turnout rate than
right.
older voters, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, but Latinos are, you know, a younger population.
Exactly.
Voters who have higher levels of education. You know, if you're college educated versus, you know, high school, you're, there's a higher likelihood that you will turn out and vote. And these things are changing in our community so that lower voter turnout rate is, I think most folks predict, is going to go up. The other thing I find really interesting in voting, because we were just talking about immigration, you know, everyone thinks, you know, if you want to get to Latino voters, all you do is talk about immigration, right?
Exactly,
that's how you
right.
court a Latino voter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? You know, when, among Latino
yeah.
voters, the top issue, not immigration.
Right.
Immigration was number six.
That's right.
Top issues were education, economy mm-hmm. and jobs, health care. Environment is an incredibly important issue to Latinos. You would never know that from the lack of interest that so many large white environmental organizations paid, you know, have in us, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Latinos are more, one of my favorites is at a point when slightly, just about half of the general American public actually believed that climate change was happening. Three quarters of Latinos knew it was happening.
Right.
This was, no problem here. We can see it, folks, right?
Right.
And their support of government actually doing something about it, you know, enforcing, you know, creating the policy that's going to stop the degradation of the environment, you know, 86% of us, we're behind it, which is higher than the general public.
Mm-hmm.
Voting is just a fascinating, you know, although in this election, right, people were so worried that, you know, Latinos were going to go more Republican. That candidate that we're not naming, I think really took care of that for us, in case we were concerned, for those of us who were concerned. But yeah.
No, that was a striking statistic to me. And it, in ways it was, in ways it wasn't. I guess in ways it was, the way it was striking, and the one I'm referring to again is that, you know, again, immigration is actually sixth on the list of issues, the top issues important for Latino voters. And this was, of course, according to the 2012 elections. Is again because it's presumed, and you know that all you got to do is, like you said, mention immigration, start talking about comprehensive immigration reform, and you're going to get Latinos out the vote. And that's actually, you know, not the case. Many Latinos have become disenchanted over the failed promises over immigration. But also, I think what it speaks to, what these concerns speak to, is that you know, what Latinos really are concerned with is what a lot of other people that are concerned with here is you know, the quality of life, right? That's what really is of issue in voting, and so thereby education, jobs, the economy, healthcare, as you mentioned, the environment. These are all issues that are, you know, much higher on the list of importance to Latinos, and you know, as opposed to immigration itself. As far as the numbers, so according to the 2012 election, there was a record-breaking 23.7 million Latinos were eligible to vote. As you mentioned, less than half. I think you said around 44-something% is what
48%.
48% would turn out to vote. And I'm not sure if you know, but do you know how does that compare to the general population? Because it seems to strike me as about on par.
It was a little bit lower. Right? It was a little bit lower than the general population, mm-hmm. Which was one of the reasons. And it was striking to people, mm-hmm. right, that the turnout was a bit lower mm-hmm. Than it had been in the prior presidential election.
Gotcha.
But, you know,
well, and that could speak to some of the disenchantment, you know, right, that we had been...
And again, the youth of, you know, we're a young population, and the turnout among young people is, you know, and millennials and is not as high as it is among senior citizens,
right?
65 and older. Well, there are a lot fewer, right, given in proportionately of those in the Latino population. So it makes some... sense, and it's something that's going to change. This population is going to age. Those folks who were, you know, were 18 then are now going to be 22 for this next election, right? More likely to vote than they were. They'll have finished college, more likely to vote than they were before. Their income may be higher. You know, that it's important to tie, as you did, that growing middle class, you know, the statistics about that households with incomes of over 50,000, over, you know, 75,000. As those grows, it's you know, almost like, you know, A plus B equals greater voter participation.
Right. Well, and since Latinos are increasingly referred to as the awakening giant, so to speak, as far as an electorate,
yes.
The projections are that by 2030, with a growth rate of about 40%, the Latino electorate is expected to reach 40 million. Almost
That's
doubling
right.
its current size. That would add essentially about an additional 16 million new Latino voters by 2030. Currently, well, this is not currently. This was a, you know, as of 2012, the 2012 election, Latinos accounted for about 10.8%, almost 11% of all registered voters. And as we know, that Latinos really inhabit a lot of the key battleground states, being particularly 14% of Florida, 18% of Nevada, and roughly 14% of Colorado. And those are the, you know, the states that are traditionally, well, maybe not Nevada, but Florida and Colorado essentially, that are tied to Latino populations. But there's also very, you know, really rapidly growing Latino populations, and they're quite historical. I think they've been building for anywhere from 50, 60 to 100 years in the Midwest, the South, you know, as of, you know, the 1920s or so, has been receiving good amounts of Latino migration. So these populations are really increasing in a lot of, you know, so-called battleground
states.
It's
one of those basic statistics that I think is really important for people to look at, and a point that we haven't addressed in our conversation. You know, we very directly, it's kind of been implied in different places. You know, we talk about Latinos. Latinos, you know, are identified by the U.S. government as people whose ancestry or themselves hail from 19 Latin American countries, right, not including Brazil, and Spain. If right. you're from one of those countries, you're a Latino, by their lights. They also, the data on the shifting populations of states, and you've named three of the most important, right, these kind of swing states, important swing states in voting. But I think just people taking a look at kind of the shifts by state in Latino population over time, and where that's headed, you know, is a really important thing, useful thing for folks to do. Mm-hmm. Who are trying to think, particularly for those of us who are working on, you know, social change and who care about the economy and all of these things and having a just economy that works for everyone, that it's important to know that we're not just in the Northeast and the Southwest and the West Coast. And, mm-hmm. Oh, and now they're in Florida, too. Yeah. Well, yeah. Well, yes, we are. We've been there. Cubans have been there. But now one of the largest Puerto Rican populations in the States is in Florida now.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
No, certainly. And I've had recent interviews with scholars studying, you know, Latinos in the heartland, also in the, as we mentioned, in the South and, you know, the Mississippi Delta region.
Right.
All that. So those are all areas that are, you know, the Carolinas, you name it. The populations are growing. You know, so I could talk about politics and voting all day long, but let's switch to another thing that's really important to Latinos, as we mentioned, as education. And, so what were some of a number of things struck me, but what are some of the most striking statistics that stood out to you in regards to Latinos in education?
Well, Latinos have always been notorious, if you will, for having one of the highest over in the, historically, very high school dropout rates, right? And we still have, you know, among African Americans, white Americans, Asians, we still have the highest dropout rate, but it's half of what it was, you know, more than less than half of what it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Right.
But the fact that I find, I think is really important and that people should know, right, is I remember years ago there was a group in New York City that did a study of Latino high school graduates and students and found that they worked so hard, right? They were trying so hard. And once they graduated, they were trying to get into college. And then it was really hard to do because they didn't have the resources. And it was unrecognized. Well, what's recognized now is that in 2012, the percentage of Latino high school graduates that went on to college was greater than the percentage of white high school graduates.
Right.
So our dropout rates are dropping, thank goodness, and the number of Latinos going on to college and all that that means in terms of, you know, the areas that we've been talking about, the economy, voting, etc., is really important for people to keep in mind. Who's in school? You know, I think it's like 1 in 4 kids in school right now are Latino. In 20 years, it'll be 1 in 3 will be Latino. So, and at the same time, guess who's not the principal and guess who's not the teacher in front of the room? You know, the mm-hmm. rates are abysmally low. I'm trying to remember the number, but it's a disgraceful percentage, nowhere near our proportion in the general population or in the school population.
Right. Well, and there's and that statistic as regards to the rapidly increasing Latino demographic in colleges is was just, I think, recently made much more clear to me as I saw articles coming out speaking about the UC itself, as far as the number of Hispanic Latino applications to the UC and enrollments was outpacing, I don't think, not just other minority groups, but even, you know, the white population for the 2015 incoming freshman class. There's another point that there are increasingly more UCs, University of California system, that is, like the University of Santa Barbara, that are becoming Hispanic-serving institutions, which means that 25% of their student body has to be Latino, and that's one of the requirements for an institution to be awarded that status. So certainly the presence is expanding, you know, quite quickly, and you're right. It's something that is left out of much of the conversation. And that's important for our, I think, for the universities to consider as well. And I even, you know, stumbled upon a couple of these discussions from, you know, small liberal arts colleges like Williams College in Massachusetts. You know, they're talking about the crisis, if you will, that's hitting small liberal arts colleges is where are they recruiting? Right, they traditionally recruit mostly from the Northeast, and as they look at their projections, they find that the amount of, you know, Anglo-white students that are graduating from college are decreasing, and that's just, you know, that's matching just the general decline in population growth with Anglo and white Americans, and it's the areas where it's increasing are with African Americans from the South and from Latinos. Right? Those are the two strongly growing demographics as regards to numbers of increasing numbers of high school graduates that are enrolling into college. And those were they were identifying those two populations in particular as
exactly
the
right.
opportunity markets, if you will. Right?
Yes, their market. Right.
Some other stats on education here. One thing I found was interesting, one of the first stats that's posted in the education chapter is that in line with the total U.S. adult population, a high school degree is the highest level of education completed by nearly a third of Latinos. And that where we really get the drop-off then is the college enrollment. But as we've just discussed, that is actually that's actually reversing itself. You know, Latinos
that's
are
right.
outpacing growth in other
time.
Sectors. You already mentioned the precipitous decline in dropout rates, a 50% decrease in just the last 25 years. So more and more Latinos, of course, are completing high school and enrolling into college. The other thing that I found quite, pleasant and encouraging was, and it's something I knew, of course, from my past experience. My parents were both educators, and my dad was a school principal, and so I always heard this from him. But it's something you don't see in the media, per se, is that Latinos' parents, not just their concern, but their involvement in their children's education is just as much in line, if not slightly higher, than other demographics, in that they attend parent-teacher meetings and help students with, you know, their homework.
And
conferences.
Yep.
I mean, all those things good, right? Good parents are supposed to do. Hello, here are the stats that Latinos are doing those things, and they've been doing those things. You know, so
that's right.
Again, I think it wasn't surprising
it's
to
not
me. Just
lack
to my
of trying.
You're right, exactly. No, that's a great point, and I think that's important. I mean, a book like this is important then in that level, with providing statistics and the data that can really help to address. Okay, what are the real policy concerns and interventions that can be made then to improve the education, you know, of our children, right? It's you know, across demographics, but particularly within, you know, urban settings where, you know, impoverished communities are really suffer. And I think that's one of the great disparities. You know, the American education system, I love to view it as it can be the great equalizer. I mean, I look at my education, you know, I was always went to public schools. My parents were public school educators. I started higher education at community college and transferred to UC and, you know, moved on to a PhD at a private institution, all those things, but it all began with public institutions, you know, public education. And, you know, the access that provides is so important, vital to our society. We didn't talk about education as part of the social safety net, and it generally isn't, and maybe its technical definition isn't included in that. But I view, indeed, perhaps one of the biggest parts of our social safety net really is the education and how much we invest in it for our children. Because, you know, that is what, again, is setting the tone for the future, both for, you know, our children themselves, how they're going to provide for themselves, but also, as we've talked already about, you know, the aging demographics in our country.
Well,
I mean, that's
Latinos
a serious concern.
As a group name education as the most important issue that we are facing, right? And that they want politicians to address. So, You are not unique. You and I are not unique. This is what a growing demographic in this population, and I would say the general population, you know, knows and understands the importance of education. Certainly the middle class does.
Right. Before we move on, I'll just read some of the other statistics that have been underlying our conversation. We've been mentioning these points, but here are the statistics for the growth of Latinos in the college population. The growth rate has been 15%, and being the fastest demographic sector that's growing in college enrollments, 15% between 2010 and 2011. another one here is over the past four decades, the numbers of Latinos receiving college degrees, associates and bachelor's degrees have grown by sevenfold, which are staggering, very important statistics.
Right. 700%. Mm-hmm. Sevenfold. It's a right. beautiful number.
Right. Right. Here's a great one. So similar to white and African American parents, counterparents, 80% or more of Latino parents of students in grades K through 12, 80%, right, attend general school meetings and parent-teacher conferences. Again, I just wanted, we've been talking about that, but I wanted to, since the book is full of these type of very specific stats, I wanted to get those numbers out there for our audience. So we're running out of time, but I do, you and I started talking about this already, before we are on air, but I definitely want to touch on the issue of Latinos and health, because there are a number of staggering points made here, particularly this Hispanic paradox, which I was wondering if you could explain for us and then address some of those surprises in regards to Latinos and health.
Of course. So the Hispanic paradox has to do with the fact that we are healthier and heartier than anyone believes we have a right to expect, even though we have among the lowest, right, rates of access to health care and health care insurance, even though our revenue and income and our ability to spend money on healthy food is lower, even though many of us live in, you know, what they call food deserts, where getting fresh produce
right.
is difficult, all of these things, despite all of that, Latinos live longer, 2.5 years longer than white Americans, 6.5 years longer than African Americans. Asians live longer than Latinos, but our average lifespan is 82.5 years,
right.
Which is really quite astounding. And efforts have been made to explain it away. Oh, it's because they're all immigrants, and, you know, immigrants eat naturally organic foods back in their home countries, so they're healthier. Once they factored, they factored that out. They factored out everything they can. The only thing that I've seen one sociologist say that they haven't factored out yet is the nature of Latino home life and that kind of familial support.
Yes, so on health, those are great points. And there's so much else we could cover, but we are out of time. So I encourage our listeners to grab a copy of this book. We're going to include a link to it on our New Books in Latino Studies page. We have a link to Amazon where it can be purchased. It's very affordable. Again, a great text. Idalise, thank you so much for coming on to New Books in Latino Studies. We so much appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation.
All right. Take care. Thanks again for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with Idalise Malave, co-author with Esti Giordani of Latino Stats, American Hispanics by the Numbers, published by the New Press in 2015. If you'd like to get in contact with us, please send us an email at newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com. You may also follow us on Facebook and Twitter or rate our podcast on iTunes.